This is the story of Shirley Jane Rose, a 9-year-old girl police say was abducted in Springfield, Missouri in 1975. Her folded remains were later found in a shallow grave north of the city. It's described as just a dip in the ground, really. Not much work put into it. No one was ever officially charged for her murder, but public perception had a man on trial nearly his entire life. A chunk of the community believes her murder was over a drug debt brought on by her mother. The toll of her memory left for the living to carry. This is that story. The path back home. It's tragic, really.
Shirley, are you here?
We all have a story.
We are contacting 911 for you.
A dark secret wrapped in emptiness and regret.
Quite frankly, I'm glad I did it.
You know.
They took her life.
They just can't prove it.
The toll. I'm Nancy Simpson. Shirley Jane Rose was at her grandmother's house in the west part of the city, the place she called home with her mom, her two brothers, and two sisters, was 5 blocks away. The plan was for her to walk home and ask her mom if she could come back and spend the night at Granny's house. And this was around 6:30, October 17th, 1975. And it was a Friday, and the papers say there'd been no school that day.
Is Shirley coming back over here? She's supposed to come home here and stay with Christy. That's when my Aunt Joyce said, well, she hasn't made it home yet. And Granny's like, she should have been there and back by now.
The fourth grader vanished. Now, some describe that main street she was walking on as busy, saying it was a main north-south thoroughfare through Springfield back in the 70s.
I don't think I would have ever let my child walk down busy street highway like that, not at 9 years old.
The little girl's mom, Joyce, called police at 7:43. That's more than an hour after Shirley Jane left Granny's. The search for her started right away. According to the papers, officers started going door to door until after midnight.
I had gone home from work that day and got the call about Shirley Jane's disappearance. So that night, I coordinated the volunteers in the search along with the officers that were searching.
Saturday morning, the search was in full swing, using any neighbor who would help, radio emergency volunteers, a helicopter, and a bloodhound. All had the goal of finding 9-year-old Shirley Jane Rose. The bloodhound would indicate Shirley went up the street from her granny's house, turned on a shortcut of sorts, and then got on the main road, which would have been a straight shot to her house. 5 blocks.
I haven't walked the route, but I've driven the route, started at the house, and just to see where she went.
Along that main road, scenic, a bloodhound named Lady Cricket would indicate Shirley Jane's trail went cold. It was in the driveway of her friend's house, just a block and a half away from her own home. But were there clues along the way? Christy Foster is Shirley's cousin. She was 6 at the time of the abduction. She was actually playing with Shirley at Granny's house the day Shirley Jane vanished.
Was this person driving by and watching us play and just waiting for her to be alone?
Shirley's plan was to come back to Granny's after a quick trip home and spend the night with Christy. That was October 17th, 1975.
Granny had called Aunt Joyce and said, is Shirley coming back over here? She's supposed to come home here and stay with Christy. And that's when my Aunt Joyce said, well, she hasn't made it home yet. And Granny's like, she left quite a while ago. She should have been there and back by now. That's the only really memory I have of that day.
Joyce Morton, not the mom, but a neighbor of Granny's, has a memory too. She was pulling out of her driveway in the car with her kids, going out to eat. Her daughter, Missy, and Shirley were the same age, and they were friends. Shirley was walking toward that main road.
Missy wants to stop and pick her up and take her out to eat with us. And she was, of course, begging. You know how kids do. They beg, oh, Mama, come on, Mama. Let me. And I said, Missy, I said, I have to go talk to her grandparents. And I said, we're in a hurry, and I want to, you know, and didn't do it. And if I'd taken the time, I don't know if it would have stopped it, but it certainly would have maybe changed things, you know. You think about that. Missy thinks about it. Missy still said, Mama, if we'd only stopped and picked her up, you know. You know, it. Really an ugly thing.
There was word a man in a blue car was seen following Shirley Jane Rose as she walked home. One witness saying he made eye contact with a man who got scared and took off. Shirley was wearing a white embroidered shirt, white pants, and tan shoes. As I walked her path she took that day, there are no sidewalks, and none I could find after researching the area from more than 4 decades ago. It's a hard walk. You're either choosing a deep ditch or walking in the road in many spots. Lieutenant Collie Wilson with the Springfield Police Department pulled a condensed version of Shirley's case file, and we sat down to go over some things.
I haven't walked the route, but I've driven the route, started at the house, and just to see where she went. Suspect, there's different witnesses said that they saw a blue car, and this is 1975, so we got to think back, possibly a Chevy, and maybe an Impala or a Chevelle, even a Nova was mentioned, and that they saw her talking to somebody in the car. And that's basically the last time they saw Shirley alive. And we're not even sure if it's Shirley, to tell you the truth. When you look at this, they don't say, yeah, that was Shirley talking to the guy. They said it was a young girl talking. Looking back, it probably is her, but it could have been somebody else. She could have been picked up somewhere else along the route. So she never comes home. Her mom calls, makes a missing persons report, and the police department then starts a pretty extensive search trying to find her.
She's found. Her body's found. A couple of men find a body near a lake 30 minutes or so north of Springfield.
So and I'll get my dates right from my outline here. October goes through, November, nothing's found. And then in December of 13 of 1975, two gentlemen who were doing some trapping up by McDaniel Lake discover a body in a shallow grave. The officers go out there and they find, you know, Shirley Jane's body there in that shallow grave up by McDaniel Lake. That's kind of just in a nutshell her disappearance and her body found. The autopsy then, and most people know this, she had a blouse tied around her neck, and her body was positively identified as, you know, Shirley Jane Rose from the autopsy.
Jack Sifford, born and raised in Springfield, moved back here and was a police officer in the city in 1975. He worked as a crime prevention officer, which also included being a media liaison. He started a CB radio volunteer club, you know, see something, say something, old school style. He helped with the search when Shirley went missing.
Yeah, there was information about somebody had seen a car near her, behind her or something, but that was all that I heard at the time.
Jack says when they got word, a car driven by a man had been seen following Shirley Jane, it appeared looking in her neighborhood would now be a waste of time. It looked like she was gone. Her grave is described as 3.5 feet long, 18 inches wide, and 18 inches deep. That's a note found in her case file. Jack knows it firsthand. He was called to the area out by the lake to take pictures of her body.
Lieutenant Richard Moses, who was the head of the detective division, called me because he knew I had a good 35-millimeter camera, and he wanted me to come up to there and take photographs, which I did.
And he gets on scene.
Gosh, it's been so long, I forget all the details, but I know it was in a out-of-the-way place, and I had to get instructions how to get in there because I grew up there. I knew where McDaniel Lake was, but this was back in the back somehow or another. And anyway, I got instructions how to walk in, and I walked in there and then met the officers that were there and Lieutenant Moses, and then saw the body and took photographs and turned that all over to the investigators. She was still clothed. Knees were bent, her legs were put behind her, may have been tied. She was still fully clothed, and she had an article of clothing or a scarf or something, I don't recall, but it was around her throat and her arms on her chest. And it wasn't really a grave she had been put in. It was just a depression in the ground that, you know, it didn't only a few inches deep, and then dirt and sticks, rocks, and stuff piled on top of her. So that was easily removed by maybe probably animals or weather or whatever.
And I don't mean to get gruesome here. You're my link. When her body was there, sure. So it would have been more toward the fall and the winter, maybe a better preservation during that time frame.
Yeah, she Yeah, there wasn't any advanced decomposition that I saw. Couldn't see her face. I think she had some of the clothing, but it was a scarf or something over her face and around her throat. But, you know, the body was intact and clothed, so it was taken that way.
And can you talk to me about her legs again? How were they positioned?
They were all the way up behind her. Like they folded her legs back behind her, not just all the way up to where her heels were, like, next to her back.
So she was almost folded in half and then put in that depression in the ground.
Yes.
The papers say the area is combed over by police for evidence or clues, but nothing is found. Detective Bill Lloyd, the lead on the case, says the girl was strangled with her own blouse. That's what Jack was seeing wrapped around her neck. Her blouse. Lloyd says she'd been in the grave for some time and that there was no way to determine if she'd been sexually assaulted. Again, 1975. Christy, her cousin, says she wasn't allowed to go to the funeral.
I remember seeing my mom and dad get in the car and leave. So it's like I had some sense that I, you know, knew something had happened, but I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral, which I kind of wished that it would have been. But I guess mom and dad thought I was only 6 and then I wouldn't understand that maybe I'd be traumatized. But I have that memory of seeing my mom and dad leave for the funeral. My mom wearing that blue velvet coat with the white fur collar. Such a weird, vivid memory.
Jack can't shake Shirley Jane Rose from his memory. He tells me he served on the police force in St. Louis before coming back to Springfield, and he says he's seen a lot of bad things. But this case bothers him the most.
I mean, it's been 42 years, and I was a St. Louis City police officer for 7 years. I've seen lots of kids who were either killed or abused, beaten, hurt, injured. And this is, for some reason, Shirley Jane Rose, for 42 years, I've thought about her hundreds of times. Every time I hear about a child abuse or a homicide, you know, I think of her. And I only saw her one time, and that was when her body was found. But I feel like I've known her for years because I think of her every time I hear something. And I mean, it's not just a little girl that I heard about. She's part of me. You know, she's with me all the time, and I never met her, never knew her. That may sound a little strange, but that's the way it is, and I know other officers the same way.
And why do you think this case hit you so hard?
Well, because I was involved in it, and you know, I took those pictures, and it's unsolved, and I just really don't like that. I can't imagine doing that to a child. I mean, there's no justification and no reason that anybody can think of to do that to a 9-year-old girl.
Christy says she asked her mom about Shirley's murder after she got older, and I didn't really know much. It was rumored her Aunt Joyce dabbled in drugs, specifically pot, and owed a drug debt.
Apparently the whole reason for this thing was because it was involving drugs and money, or lack of money, and that's what caused the whole thing to turn out the way it did.
Jack, the retired police officer, says this case really wore on lead detective Bill Lloyd.
Yeah, I know that it bothered Bill considerably, and he worked diligently trying to find out who did it, but Bill had a young son who was, I forget what he had, and he had a problem too. He was either mentally retarded or Down syndrome. I don't remember, but he had a young son. So anything and of course, most of us, anything that bothers a child bothers a policeman more than most people because we've seen too much of it, you know.
But Jack says the case likely haunted Lloyd like it did because he was sure he knew who did this.
Here's the only thing I know about suspects, and I got this from Bill Lloyd before Bill died. Before I left the police department in 81. And before that, I had talked to Bill one time, and he told me that there were 2 brothers, I thought. Best I can recall, there were 2 brothers, and they were Fletchers, and with the Fletcher barbecue place that was on Scenic and Sunshine. And that they were in an interrogation room and Bill was talking to them in there, and then he left on purpose because there were microphones in the room. So he left and they listened to the two guys having a conversation. And during the conversation, one of them was heard to say, "We killed her," or something to that effect. Well, Bill asked them about that later, and they said, no, they didn't say that. They said it was like rhetorically, one of them said, "What if they come in and say we killed her?" You see what I mean? And Bill could not, he could not verify exactly what they said because there was some, either they didn't record it or didn't turn the recorders on, or there was a problem with the recorders or something, but they had no recording of that conversation. It was just Bill hearing what they were, this discussion inside the room. So that couldn't be used.
That could explain his double frustration, couldn't it?
Yes. But he felt sure that it was them.
The two brothers.
That abducted her. He was very sure of that. He said he just didn't have any doubt, but he just could not get any evidence otherwise.
Steve and Chris Fletcher's family owned the barbecue restaurant, which was just down the street from Shirley's home. Same street, which I feel the need to point out because this fact alone would have put him in the area all of the time. Good or bad, however this shakes out, I feel this is an important fact. And just a note, almost everyone I spoke to about this case said one name. Steve Fletcher.
I hope it was Fletcher since he was kind of blamed for it.
He passed away years ago.
I always just wondered why, what proof they would have needed in order to make the case on those two guys and put them away for good.
Meeting with Lieutenant Cully Wilson and Sergeant Todd King with the Springfield Police Department, they tell me this cold case file gets pulled from the shelf and looked over about once a year. Lieutenant Wilson didn't just confirm this story. He was able to pull the report from the file pretty quickly.
I know what you're talking about, and it's kind of a one blurb thing in there, but I don't know any evidence that connects that right now to that statement. So I know the statement you're talking about, but I don't know, unless I've missed it somewhere in there. I've actually tried to look, because this is a pretty damning statement. I've tried to look for some link, or maybe there's, you know, I thought, well, maybe there is a recording. No, there's not, but I don't have any other evidence of them saying yes or no that I know of. Now, I may have missed it somewhere, but I don't believe so.
You haven't seen it written down anywhere? Nothing.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it written down. Yeah, it's definitely written in a report. I mean, that's it. I keep it in front of this. Let me see what I got to do. Since you already know about it.
Hold up. I know you don't have your glasses on at all.
No, I'm not going to let you see it yet because there are some details in here that I don't want out yet. Take a look at it. Tell me what you think. There are some stuff in there.
But the essence of Detective Lloyd believing this seems to ring true.
That does. He wrote it. He put it in a report. It's a short report, but yeah.
It only looked four lines long. Yeah. Five lines long. Does that sway an investigator?
When you're in your mind,
that you think something.
Anytime you get that piece, your mind's going to go whoop, and then I'm going to go this way with this. What you got to do as an investigator is, at some point, you can run with it. You know, start. That's a good lead. Let's go with it. But at one point, you got to, you know, if it's starting, you got to stop every once in a while and go, okay, am I going? And that's the checks and balances as a good investigator of, do I keep going with this or do I need to stop, step back, and then look at everything? Or I need to keep going with it, step back, go to my supervisor, my sergeant, and go, this is what I got. I'm wanting to go this way. And our guys do that a lot because as investigators, our group are a tight-knit group, and we bounce ideas off each other all the time and really use that. But it's easy. You get, especially on a case like this, you get that, oh, wow, I heard him say this, man, let's go with it. And I could see it being easy, very easily get tunnel vision on something like that. But you got to realize when the well starts running dry, you may have to start digging somewhere else. So, your opinion?
it's not anything that's like earth shattering.
No.
Oh my gosh, but it's just,
there's some pieces in there that, there's some pieces in there that could be, we could use later on. I will confirm that the question you asked about hearing them say something, yeah, that's true. This is what this is.
Okay.
But without giving you all the details of what's in, what was said, what he heard, I'm not ready to give you that yet.
Okay.
Okay.
But Jack's story's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
We found Cloyd Steiger. He was with the Seattle Police Department for 36 years, most of those as a homicide detective. He's now with the Washington State Attorney General's Office. He's a chief criminal investigator in the Homicide Tracking System Division. And he's seen a lot, too. He wrote a book called Homicide, The View from Inside the Yellow Tape, a true crime memoir. I asked him to weigh in on certain aspects of this case, this being one of them, tunnel vision, being a detective, also being human.
Now, if that was the case and he knew that they said that, you could see why he's focusing in on them. It's absolutely devastating that that wasn't being recorded at the time. I don't have a problem with focusing on that if that's what you heard. But I do have a problem with the detectives who decide what the answer is at the beginning and only look for evidence that matches their theory. You know, you have to go where the evidence takes you. And if it takes you completely the opposite direction that you were going at one point, then you have to turn around and go that direction. Like I said, I've investigated hundreds of murders, some very simple, some very complex. And in almost all of them where the person wasn't arrested at the scene by patrol before I got there, the first few days you start out investigating things that ends up having nothing at all to do with your case because it's just all this information's coming in and you're focusing here and focusing there. But if you did hear two brothers say, you know, we did this, we got to do something, yeah, that's certainly a reason to focus on them. You certainly can't eliminate all other information you get, but I don't have a problem with them focusing on them if it really happened, you know, and that's true. So, it's kind of a mixed bag. It's hard to go back and say, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that. But you do have to go. You have to follow the signs, the evidence you have, and information you have coming in. You have to go where that takes you and don't assume it's not correct just because you have a different theory. That's what a bad detective does. A bad detective decides what the answer is and then goes out looking for information to support his thesis. You have to go with the flow and go where it takes you. And if it takes you to a completely opposite direction that you think you should go, you have to go there.
Looking over the old newspaper articles, a couple of men, 22 and 24, are arrested on suspicion of murder. Now, the younger one reportedly had a car that matched the description of one that may have been near Shirley Jane, at least according to witnesses. The car is impounded. It doesn't appear officers found anything. The prosecutor in Greene County at the time was contacted about possible charges against these suspects. The paper says the parents of one of the men were talking to detectives. This little line leads me to believe that these are not the Fletcher brothers referenced by former officer Jack Sifford. Lieutenant Wilson says, I'm right.
We have other suspects that we know of, other than Mr. Fletcher. In fact, we arrested two of them, I said back in 75. But I don't have any, you know, there's no evidence.
Were those the two men who were arrested at the same time?
Yeah.
Are they dead?
Nope.
But they were arrested and then let go.
Correct.
There's an interview Joyce, Shirley Jane's mom, did with the paper on the 20th anniversary of the little girl's death. That's going to be 1995. She passed away in 2002.
You know, rumor. But I heard that her mom was involved in drugs. And I'm sure that's come up before, too. And that this was revenge.
Apparently the whole reason for this thing was because it was involving drugs and money, or lack of money. And that's what caused the whole thing to turn out the way it did.
She's, again, forcefully denying a police theory that her 9-year-old daughter was killed because of a bad drug deal. She tells the Springfield Newsleader, the paper, she never owed drug money. She'd pay up front, then purchase more with the money that was left over after paying bills and getting groceries. Then she gives this. She says she once bought some marijuana that had been dried in a clothes dryer. That process burned out the chemical that creates a high. This made her marijuana worthless, so she had a party and just gave it all away. A big-time drug dealer, whose name was Jim Snake Man Sullivan, met Joyce Rose before his untimely death. He was murdered ambush style. He told her that she had embarrassed the man who sold her the pod and his supplier. He said taking Shirley Jane was a payback. Joyce told the reporter that was the only thing that anyone said at the time that made any sense. She tells the paper she knows police found her not helpful during the initial investigation. She says she was afraid. Her quote, "I had a little girl missing. I was dealing drugs. I just kept waiting for them to take my other kids away from me. I remember being at the funeral and feeling like I was up on a hill. I could see the people and I felt sorry for them, but I didn't feel like I was there." She told the reporter she had her own theories about who killed her daughter.
Yeah, I've always had Fletcher in mind, and for no reason other than what law enforcement said. You know, that was a belief for many years that he was involved, that there's some kind of drug deal. In fact, just off the top of my mind, it seems like there's even a rumor that she was made to start digging her own grave.
She also said she'd now cooperate with police to bring her daughter's killer to justice. That never happened. At the time of her death, Shirley has a sister who is 16, a 15-year-old brother, a 13-year-old brother, and a sister who was a toddler. The house they lived in was split into a duplex. It's still there. As the years passed and no one was charged for her murder, people started talking about other theories. Did she make it home? No one has ever come forward to say they saw her get pulled into a car or climb into a vehicle of any kind. So is that really what happened? Or did she make it home? I'm not saying her family had anything directly to do with her murder, but you do have to pose the question.
I just think I go back to family, too. I'm kind of like, I you know, whether she was involved with someone. And nobody knows any of that, I guess. Wouldn't they have asked if she had been involved with somebody?
Lieutenant Wilson.
I think the detectives then, and if we were doing this investigation now, which we would conduct it, you know, differently, we would have to, and I still think, you know, did she make it home and somebody in the house took her? So, yeah, we have to keep that in the scenario because nobody, like I said earlier, nobody's saying, yeah, that was Shirley Jane, and she was talking to this guy in a blue car. Could she have made it home? Possibly. From the investigation and the officer's interviews there, there's no direct evidence that she did. You know, mom says she didn't. So could she have made it home and somebody got out of there? Yeah. We know that mom had some shady dealings with some folks there, and that possibly could have happened. But if I was going to bet money on it right now, mine would be more before she got home, just because there's so much more opportunity for someone to take her off the street than to kidnap her at home.
Joyce told the paper no one in the house, other than her, was interviewed by police. I've reached out to Shirley's siblings to try and answer these questions. So far, they've refused to do interviews. Lieutenant Wilson has no answer here.
If she said that, you know, I'd believe her then. I'd just have to go back and look in the case to see if we did or not. At the beginning of it, it's kind of weird to say, but we don't believe anybody. And we want to believe, you know, we got to take everything that's told to us with speculation. So I'd speculate, you know, I'd have to go back whether I believe her or not. I don't know. If she said that, I would immediately, as investigator, go back and go, did we interview these kids? And go back and look at that.
Would investigating in 1975 something like this be different than these days?
No.
Seems like these days you really focus on the family.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a lot different.
Do you see that in this case?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we kind of talked about the release of information. The amount of homicides we have now, our guys are more savvy on it and really going to these things, knowing what they're going to do, kind of knowing the game plan. Todd King's done this for many, many years, and he's knows how to direct our guys what to do. And if we went into something like this today, every family member is going to be interviewed, no question.
No way that mom would ever make that statement.
Correct.
Under what's going on.
If she made that statement, it would have been false today. We would make every attempt to interview everybody. It's frustrating now because you look back, and it's so easy for me to sit here in this chair and look back 40 years ago and go, oh, they should have done this way, they should have done it this way. In the 1970s, policing was really starting a really change into more technology and the tools we use today. I mean, you still had officers walking beats without portable radios back then, carrying blackjacks, you know. Today, every officer has a computer in their car, mace, taser, that sort of thing. So technology is changing. Springfield was changing as well from a smaller rural community to what we're becoming, you know, today. So yeah, it is frustrating, but you got to take it that that's the way it was, and that's the way they did things. I think back then the detectives were doing the best they could, and they, you know, they weren't trying to shortcut anything. It's just the training wasn't there yet, the technology wasn't there yet, and you know, today it's like we're talking about interviewing the kids that wouldn't have went by. We wouldn't have not interviewed them. For me to speculate, and that's for me to look back, I would say they may have got a little bit of tunnel vision on this, her being abducted before she got to the house. I may have been looking at that.
He says they've tested for DNA on that critical piece of clothing, but nothing. At least nothing yet. It's been several years since a test was conducted, and Steiger in Seattle, he says he has access to brand new testing.
The chances are this guy has done other crimes. He may not have done any other murders, but he may have done rapes, child molests. And if they get a DNA profile, there's a very good chance he's in CODIS already. He could be in prison somewhere right now today, or he could be dead, but he's probably in CODIS. And if they can get a DNA match, that's why I would encourage him to find out if the state of Missouri has an MVAC system in their crime laboratory system and then have it done. And if not, find one else. They can give me a call. I'll come up with an MVAC and have that stuff processed. And the chances are exponentially higher of getting a DNA profile using that system than any system that was used in 2006.
Lieutenant Wilson agreed to talk to him about it. Next time on The Toll.
One of the detectives asked me if I knew how to handle a shotgun. And I said, yeah. He said, here, take one. So I was armed with a cassette recorder, a microphone, and a 12-gauge.
The memory. Strictly the memory. It was so ugly.
Quite frankly, I'm glad I did it.
No guilt.
I ain't got a bit of remorse.
Are these the only three people you've killed?
No, well, they're not the first.
There was a tip that the police got that there was going to be a human sacrifice at a quarry north of Springfield. I assumed that that human was going to be Shirley Jane Rose. I said, oh, please, you got to let me go.
If you enjoyed this and want to continue the journey, please subscribe to The Toll. The Toll podcast, The Path Back Home, is a production of The Toll, LLC. Co-creator and host, Nancy Simpson. Co-creator and executive producer, Jay Lashley. Technical producer and audio editor, Kat Morgan Gaines. Marketing manager, Pamela Shelby. Web design and digital creative director, Shelby Powers. Technical analyst for digital strategy, Christina Oswald. Special thanks to Eliza Blackwood, transcriptionist, and Austin Robertson, voiceover. Original theme by Jay Lashley. Additional music by FirstCom. Reproduction or use of any part of this podcast without the express permission of The Toll LLC is prohibited. Get updates at our website, thetollpodcast.com.